Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. You can find him on Twitter at HMacBE. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
Great to be on again.
Hilliard, the U.S. Fed hiking rates once again. Is this warranted, considering that U.S. inflation officially is now below 3%?
You know, there's a great debate about how far the Fed should go. Usually the history of it is that the Fed will hike and hike and hike until something breaks. And some of us thought that the failure of three large banks in earlier this year, about 3 months ago, was definitely qualifies as something breaking. However, the Fed is looking at other factors, and they, for instance, they find that the economy is still pretty strong and unemployment is still very low, and they're worried, obviously very worried about inflation. So even though the headline number was below 3%, the underlying numbers are showing, you know, greater strength than that sub 3% rate would indicate. And I guess that's why they're continuing to go. But the history of these things is that they usually go too far. They obviously went too far when they kept rates so low, basically at 0% for so many years. They kept them low for way too long. And the odds are that they'll go too far the other way, and they'll go too high. And until a recession starts, they never want to admit it. But basically, the way to get inflation under control is to force the economy into a recession. And they probably won't stop until they do that. And of course, with the way economic numbers work, they're reported late. They're often long behind reality. We might already be in a recession. Certainly, Germany's in a recession. England's probably in a recession. Canada might be in a recession. Who knows if the U.S., when after a few revisions of numbers, you know, a few months from now, we'll look back and say, hey, you know what? The recession started in the spring of 2023. We just didn't know we were in a recession.
My little sister has an interesting note. She works at a co-op store in Peace River, Alberta, which, for the curious, is 500K north of Edmonton. It's north. Anyway, she is noticing that customers at her store are handing in older bank notes. In other words, they're going into their secret stash to survive right now.
There's the next thing you know, they'll be bringing in jars full of pennies and asking you to count them all out.
But these are older bank notes. Bank notes from the 60s and 70s.
Imagine how much the government benefits from people taking those notes and then just tucking them away in a drawer somewhere. And we've all got them, and it's a huge amount of money that's sort of like free to the economy. But when people are desperate, they'll do desperate things. You could look at pawn shops and see if the people are turning in some of their older valuables in order to get some money and some cash. But we've got a little bit better indicators than that. We can look at things like credit card defaults, and those are starting to soar now. Auto loans, it's really interesting with auto loans because the interest rate on auto loans has been shooting higher and higher, and the length of the loans is now on average up to something like 84 months. So obviously people are very stretched. $1,000 a month payments on automobile purchase loans is becoming pretty standard. And people just, you know, with the combination of mortgage interest rates going up 40, 50, 60%, if variable rates get renewed at the higher rate, and things like auto loans going up, credit card payments being behind, at some point, a recession would hit. And that should be the way that it should work. But, you know, it could get drawn out because, in this new era, when everybody is sort of trying to shield the average person from the reality of the situation, the lenders are being very, very generous with their terms. People are being allowed to extend the term. I mean, there's people that have mortgage repayment terms of 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years now because the banks have not increased the payments to reflect the higher interest rates yet. So maybe people are still walking around thinking that they can afford a lifestyle that they can't afford. And the Federal Reserve raising the rates is trying to get at that a little bit in terms of we allowed people to borrow too much, we allowed them to pay interest rates that were way too low, and now we have to do something about that. But you know, it could be very harsh for some people.
Now, I've just received an email from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, and they say the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation has dished out $75 million in bonuses since the beginning of 2020. More than 90% of its workforce has been getting a bonus in recent years. CMHC claims it's driven by just one goal, housing affordability for all. However, according to the Royal Bank of Canada, buying a home has never been so unaffordable. So really, should millions and tens of millions of dollars be given to CMHC in the way of bonuses? It seems to me they've been an abject failure.
Well, you know, they say that housing affordability is their goal, but actually, and it's not their fault because they don't have control over these things, but actually they've contributed to making housing unaffordable. And the way they contributed to it is when they issue the insurance for the loan, what they do is they say to the bank, oh, you can lend, well, there used to be no limit. You could go above $1 million. Now the limit is $1 million. You can lend $1 million to a young couple that can't really afford to take out $1 million loan, but the lender can do it because the CMHC will guarantee the loss if the couple turns out to not be able to repay that loan. So if you accept the premise, which I believe is correct, that house prices will rise to the level that the banks are willing to lend at, then the CMHC is fundamentally encouraging lenders to lend much larger amounts of money than people really would normally be allowed to borrow. If the bank was worried about the loss on that loan, if there's no insurance on it from the CMHC or the other mortgage insurance companies, they would say, oh, no, we're not going to lend $1 million to that young couple. The most we can lend them is $300,000, right? So then what would happen? House prices would have to come down to $300,000. That's the only way that works. And we know that partly because in Germany, that's exactly the way it works. You have to walk in with a 30, 40% down payment, and the bank sits down with you and goes through all of your financial statements for the last couple of years to see if you're able to save money, if you're a good manager of your financial affairs, and then the bank becomes kind of like a partnership with the home buyer in order to help them get through the next 30, 40 years. But in Canada, it's completely the opposite. The bank doesn't even care. As well, and the irony of it is that it's the home buyer that pays the premium on the insurance. So the home buyer pays the insurance premium, which means day one, they're actually underwater on their mortgage. Their loan to value is 104% or something like that of the value of the house. Once the bank doesn't care, because if the couple is unable to repay that loan, the bank just goes to the CMHC and says, give us back our loss. We're claiming our insurance. And so it's the only country in the world that I could find when I was writing my book, that has such a generous, option. There is one in the U.S. that's similar, but it's much smaller. And there's a yearly insurance premium. So people try and get out of it as quickly as they can, because the insurance premium is quite onerous. And it encourages people to try and relieve themselves of the obligation of paying the insurance premium. But in Canada, it's a one-time payment. It lasts for the length of the mortgage. And everybody is happy. The only problem will be if defaults start to soar, CMHC will not have the money to pay the banks the losses on their mortgages that they've handed out, and then CMHC will have to go to the government to get their capital replenished, and that'll be interesting. that'll become very political at some point when that has to happen.
Right, and we do have, I guess, in the not too distant future, a federal election coming up. In Canada, the Prime Minister shuffled the cabinet, but the main faces remain the main faces, and the other 30 or 40 or 50 other minions he has, they were nameless before, and I think they're nameless now.
Yeah, I don't think most people really could name even. They might be able to name two cabinet ministers, if that, and a lot of them can't name any. So they don't really care about that. What they do care about, though, is their price of their house, the monthly payment on their mortgage, the monthly payment on their car loan, and that's been going up. In a universe where mortgages usually mature after 5 years in terms of the payment schedule, not the amortization of the full mortgage, say 25, 30 years, but the rate is set for 5 years or less. 20% at least 20% of the mortgages are up for renewal every year. And when you add in variable rate mortgages, it could be as much as 40 or 50% are up for renewal every year for the next couple of years. So that kind of hit is going to be, really noticeable for people. And, the rate increases started about a year and a half ago at the end of 2021, early 2022. So, we're sort of a year and a half into this, and so people will really start to see. Do people pay attention to that? I don't know. I don't know if they do. I suspect they took out the mortgage when it was 2% or 1.5%, and their payments are $1,500 a month. They're going to be shocked to find out that the payments now are $2,500 a month or even $3,000 a month. And some of them will be able to handle it, and some of them won't be able to handle it. But we won't know until the full impact. But unless they continue to do some of the policies that they're currently doing, which is extending the amortization periods, if that doesn't prevail, if that's only a temporary situation, we should be able to tell within a year or two. Out of all those people that bought homes in the last, especially the ones that bought homes from 2020 on, how many of them were on the edge and couldn't really afford higher payments, and how many of them are fine? I mean, the people that bought 20 years ago, unless they refinanced their mortgages, they should be in great shape, and the new interest rates won't kill them. But it's the ones that have bought more recently in the last 5 years that they had to stretch to buy those houses because the prices were so high, and If a recession comes in, their jobs might not be as secure as they thought, and that's where you get that crisis, economic crisis, caused by an unusual credit crunch, which we haven't had, by the way, in Canada since the 1990s. So we don't know. Most of the people in charge now have no experience with that kind of stuff because they haven't been around long enough to remember what it was like. Mm-hmm. And you have to really go back to the early 1980s to see something as big as what we're currently facing in terms of when the interest rates got up to 19% and people were losing their homes. So we'll see. I mean, who knows how it's going to be handled. And the reason it's so hard to predict is because you don't know how the government is going to react to a bunch of people being unable to pay their debts, and especially their mortgage.
Yeah. Back in 1981, Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, a little town 45 minutes outside of Regina, a developer couldn't sell his block of houses he had just built. As you said, mortgage rates were at 18% at the time. So he started to bulldoze them. Unfortunately, his wife was in house number 4 after he'd wrecked 3. And she was in the living room when he started to rip that house apart. And the police had to put a warning shot through the windshield of his Caterpillar, of his front end loader, to stop his rampage. And then for a month, people from all over Saskatchewan were circling around, because I only lived a block away from there, were circling around to take a look at this damage. And the bulldozer was still halfway into the house with a bullet hole just above where the driver's head would have been. That's what can happen when mortgage rates go nuts. We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, when is this bursting bubble going to hit the scene? Are we going to see a rapid decline in real estate prices next year, I think, because of this, where people are going to be selling their homes at desperate prices?
You know, it's hard to... my alerting to the housing bubble bursting 7 years ago was way too early. So I'm reluctant to make a timing prediction, but you mentioned just now something interesting, which is related to the housing bubble bursting, and that is house builders. So house builders, the way house builders work is if they can get the financing, they keep building, and they can't really predict macroeconomic trends. Who can really? Nobody knows when the housing bubble is going to burst, and what happens is they tend to notice that if they build 20 houses this year and they could have sold 40, and then if they build 40 next year and they could have sold 60, well, the third or fourth year or the fifth year that happens to them, they try and build 100 houses. And then what happens is they can only, when the tide turns, then they can only sell 80 of those 100 houses and they go bankrupt. And that has been so long since that happened that most home builders are extremely confident. And they don't have any kind of a brake pedal close to them. All they have is a gas pedal. And so when people say, well, and they do say this to me, they say, well, your prediction might be right, but it might be wrong. But what you've forgotten is that when people see prices going down, they won't sell their house. They'll just take it off the market. And there's some evidence that that's what's happening now with the listings being as low as they are. They're record low levels in some cities. People obviously are looking at the weak prices that we've experienced for probably about a year now in Canada and say, well, I'm not going to sell my price because my neighbor sold their house for $2 million and there's no way I'm accepting $1.6 million because my house is better than their house. So they sit on the house waiting for the prices to go back up, and then eventually maybe they get convinced to sell at an even lower price if they're forced to sell for some reason, or if the kids get involved, or who knows, but whatever scenario. But what's missing in that is the new home builders. So the new home builders, they are forced to sell, either because they've overcommitted and they borrowed too much money and they have to sell the houses at a loss in order to just repay the loans. Or if they really are stubborn, what happens is the lender moves in and takes over the project, and the lender doesn't care. The lender just says, okay, just sell them for whatever we can get for them and let's get this resolved. So it would be the new home builder, whether it be single family homes or condos. And there's an interesting thing in condos called pre-construction assignment sales, where you could see people forced to sell, unlike the single family, older single family home owner who might just pull the house off the market. So that's the thing to watch. And that will be a really good predictor of if we're starting into the, so far we've just had a mild downturn in the market. I think the official numbers from CREA are like prices are down 10%. At the worst, they were down 20%. Those numbers are somewhat massaged by the people that put out the index, but that's not really a bursting of the bubble. That's just a pause. what we would really have to see would be 30 or 40% to be a bubble bursting. And we wouldn't see that unless we get into a situation where new home builders are forced to sell, or other people are forced to sell because the lender gets involved and goes through bank, you know, foreclosure or power sale, that sort of thing. And so far, whether the government and the lenders have talked about this, I suspect they have, there's been a decision at the policy level made to hold off on forcing people to make those drastic choices and, you know, help them get through this has generally been the leadership that's been put out there. So how much longer that lasts, I don't know. I'm watching closely the, there's a thing in the U.S. We don't have the data in Canada, are not nearly as good as the U.S., but in the U.S. they have some pretty good data. There's one called a Senior Loan Officer Survey, and it's financial conditions. And they do a survey of 17 large banks, 100 smaller banks, and they ask them, are conditions tighter than they used to be? In other words, is it more difficult to get a loan? Or are they the same, or are they looser? And so lately, the number of banks that have gone and answered that question, the question on our financial conditions tighter, has gone up from something like 25 or 30% to 45 or 50%, a huge increase in that number. And that's because the banks are, you know, after what happened with those three banks that failed in March, the banks are getting much more careful about who they lend money to and how much they lend in the U.S. And that's a sign that the credit conditions are going to get difficult, and this is what drives the housing market is two things: availability of credit and cost of credit. Well, the cost of credit has gone up for sure. We know mortgage rates now are 6.5-7%, so it's just becomes the availability of credit.
Are banks foreclosing on people, or are they doing what I call massaging the conditions of the mortgage to keep the people in their house?
They are helping them stay in their home. And whether it's an official rule, I know that the regulator, OSFI, the Office of Superintendent of Financial Institutions, put out some requests for feedback on some changes that they're expecting. The feedback period is for September. And of course, you know, who knows what the way it goes is very simply, they ask the banks, what should we do? Should we tighten conditions? And the banks say, well, you could do that. But you realize if you do that, then a whole bunch of people are going to lose their homes. And then, the government says, well, we don't want to do that, especially not, you know, immediately prior to an election. So what else can we do? And so there's that. And then I think the banks too, have adopted a much gentler kind of a demeanor with people that have borrowed a bunch of money, partly because the bank is the one that encouraged them to borrow all that money. The bank told them they could afford to borrow that much money. So, it's kind of hard to turn around the next month and say, wait a minute, we have to call that loan because you've borrowed too much. And the guy says, the borrower says, well, you're the one that told me to borrow that. It's not my fault. And, anyway, that's an interesting discussion. In fact, the only time it's really happened on a widespread basis was in the early 80s when interest rates went up to 19%. And the banks in Alberta, I don't know about Ontario, but the banks in Alberta, they actually brought in new people because you can't have the loan officer that was the one that was encouraging people to take more money a few months before or a couple of years before. The friendly banker was replaced by the nasty banker, the one with the sharp pencil and the eye shades and all that. And those bankers were brought in to explain to people that they had to come up with some more money right away, or else their house was going to be seized and it was going to be foreclosed on, and they were going to lose their house. So sometimes that, you know, I haven't seen any sign of that yet. We're still in the first phase where the people are basically, the lenders are acting as if they're your friends still. So I don't know. It's going to be a shock when the bank changes to the nasty version of that scenario.
The real estate situation in China, how bad is it?
So China's gone through, you and I talked a couple of years ago about a company called China Evergrande, which is one of the largest real estate developers. So they got into trouble, big trouble, and they were huge. I mean, they owed a total of $300 billion U.S. dollars. It's just impossible to fathom that amount of money. And what they did was they built apartments primarily for Chinese people, residential real estate. And basically, the way it works in China is that people tend to buy those apartments. They keep them as an investment. They don't actually move into them. So the apartments are sold with bare walls, no finishing, no furnishings and no finishings. And they tend to hold their value, at least they have up until now. And they just kept building. And there was these stories about, you know, ghost cities with, you know, hundreds of high rise towers that people had invested in. And as long as the price kept rising, people were happy to just sit and hold on to those units. But now what happened was China Evergrande and now a few of the other ones have been unable to complete those projects. So they took the money. Oh, and the other thing that's true about China is that unlike in Canada, when they buy those apartments, they put up the full cost. So the costs are lower, obviously, over there. But if it's a $200,000 apartment, they have to put up the full $200,000 before the apartment is built. So China Evergrande was able to expand quite rapidly, and they had all this free money, essentially from these investors. But when the credit crunch hit, and part of it was triggered by the government brought in some new policies a couple of years ago that all of the big developers had to meet certain red lines. It turned out China Evergrande couldn't complete these apartments. So initially when you and I talked about this, it was 2 years ago, the China Evergrande was the only company that was in this situation. Now, pretty much all of the developers in China are in the same position. They're all in trouble. And the way we measure it is by the value, the quality of their loans that they've borrowed, the money that they've borrowed in American dollars from foreign investors. And that's a very large amount of money. In China Evergrande's case, it was $20 billion U.S. that they had borrowed out of the $300 billion that they owed, was owed to foreign investors. The domestic stuff can be taken care of with help from the government, and it's in the local currency, but those foreign loans are the problem. And now several other, including Country Garden Holdings, which is the largest developer in China, we've seen that their bond values have plummeted, which means people are thinking that they might not be able to repay those foreign dollar loans. So it's an example of a bubble bursting. And it's interesting to watch because the government of China is obviously more involved in the private sector than we're used to in North America. So they have been unable to do anything about stopping this bursting of this bubble. They keep bringing out new policies. This week they brought out another set of new policies, but it's a very difficult situation. Once people start defaulting on loans, everybody gets scared, and nobody's willing to lend, and buyers of new apartments are unwilling to buy. So the news that came out this week was China. So in the last 2 years, China Evergrande never released their financial reports, and they finally released them this week, and they said that they lost $81 billion U.S. dollars over that 2 year period. So that was a bit of a shock to the market. And then the accounting firm, which was a large international accounting firm, had been replaced by a smaller local accounting firm. And the local firm said, we cannot give full assurance on the validity of these results because we didn't have access to all the data. So even that number, $81 billion, might be understated because the accounting firm was unable to confirm it. So it's that's the way it goes when there's that amount of debt. So we would expect in Canada if something similar would happen, the government would get very involved. But it may be that the government is unable to stop the unwinding of the boom that is turning into a bust.
Well, and I would be worried if China's economy gets into real, real trouble, that their reaction to that is going to be invade Taiwan, because the classic thing for a despotic leadership to do is to create a war to take people's minds off their bad economy. The classic example would be Argentina invading the Falkland Islands back in the 1980s. Their economy was in the dumper, and they invaded.
Yeah, a distraction would be very useful for the Chinese government right now. They're struggling with a lot of different things, and they're making a lot of progress too in some areas. Like, for instance, they're leading in electric vehicle sales by far. One of their companies, BYD, is rivaling Tesla in terms of the number of cars sold. They're actually exporting Chinese battery electric vehicles to Germany, which is shocking to the highest degree. I don't think that'll last much longer. Some of the German car makers are starting to make an electric vehicle offering. But they're also building an immense amount of solar and wind power in production in China, although they still need to make new coal plants as well, because their electricity demand is still growing rapidly. So it's a mixture over there, and I wouldn't count China out in terms of future GDP growth, but the residential investment sector was such a large part of the economy over there, as it is in Canada, that going through a slowdown or a crash like they are in that sector has to drag the whole economy down, at least for a period of time. The difference though in China though is that they have the ability to ramp up their non-residential sector in infrastructure and business and exports and all that kind of stuff. Whereas in Canada, we're more reliant on consumer spending. Consumer spending in Canada, the U.S. is 65-70% of the economy. So if there's a bursting of the housing bubble in Canada, that's really going to hurt our economy, because obviously consumers are not spending as much if they're losing their home, or if the value of their home is going down, they can't borrow as much, that sort of thing. Whereas in China, the consumer spending is a much smaller. It's only like 35 or 40% of the economy. So there's lots of other levers that the Chinese government can pull to keep things going. So I wouldn't cut them out. The one thing that would really hurt China though is a slowdown in the U.S. consumer, because a lot of their economy depends on making stuff for us in North America and sending it to us. You push that button on the Amazon, and the next day the item shows up. It comes from China, unless there's a strike at the port. And that's a big part of their economy. If that ever slowed down, and it would slow down in the recession, then China would be really struggling. They'd have two major headwinds to their economy.
Well, with the U.S. trying to bring factories home from China and be more self-reliant, are the Chinese nervous about that?
I'm sure they are, and they had a plan which was announced 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, called Made in 2025, which is they didn't want to buy anything from elsewhere. They wanted to have everything sourced from China. So that helps with being so reliant on exports. They're now making stuff for themselves. And so if they open up a new nuclear plant or a new coal-fired plant, or they've already done it in solar and wind, they make all their stuff themselves. But companies like Siemens from Germany and some of the other big engineering companies in Europe, they still sell big power equipment, transformers and things like that. And China is building out that infrastructure very rapidly. But very soon, by 2025, the mandate is to make all of that stuff locally. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're able to do it. The other big push that they're doing in China is artificial intelligence. They were talking about that internally at least 2 or 3 years ago. They were putting a big push on in artificial intelligence. So now whether they're able to match the U.S. companies like NVIDIA, I don't know. But that helps China, but it will also hurt them a lot to lose some of this manufacturing. But I can't imagine all that manufacturing shifting to the U.S. I just don't think the U.S. and Canada have the ability to make that stuff the way China does. The cost alone would be a major factor in prohibiting a big transfer of manufacturing from China or now Vietnam and some of those other countries to North America. Our costs would be much, much higher for some of that stuff. And quite frankly, the Chinese are just better at it, right? So it doesn't make sense for us to try and duplicate that.
Hilliard, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, the one thing that happened yesterday was, as you and I have discussed, I've been a Tesla owner for quite a while now, since 2016. And I'm on my third model. And one of the tricks about owning a Tesla is if you want to get the fully self-driving, it's an optional extra you have to pay. And when you upgrade your Tesla, a very annoying thing happens. You have to buy it again. So you pay for the fully self-driving, which isn't really here yet. Elon Musk keeps saying it's going to be here by the end of the year, but it's been saying that for 5 years now. So you pay this money for something that isn't quite ready yet. I mean, I've been using it, but it's still not ready for prime time, if you like. And I've bought it twice. Like, I paid it once when I upgraded the first time, and then in 2021, I paid it again when I upgraded to the new Model S called the Plaid. And so anyway, I got a phone call last night. It said, if you want to upgrade, we'll let you transfer the fully self-driving. You won't have to pay the fees on the new car. And it sounded like the phone call sounded like it was coming from a room full of people, you know, like a telemarketing. And I thought, wow, what is this? Are their sales slowing? And they know that existing Tesla owners are probably the most likely people to buy another Tesla. I don't know. But the problem is, I said to the caller, I said, well, I've already got the model Plaid. There isn't another model. Until you guys bring out a Roadster or something, there isn't anything I can upgrade to. So don't call me but with this offer that I can't take advantage of. But maybe it's a sign that vehicle sales are slowing, because certainly that statistic that we talked about a minute ago, that the payments are now up to $1,000 a month, that's going to slow a lot of people down in terms of trying to buy a new car.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Nice to chat with you.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. Maybe Twitter's called X. We're not sure yet. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.